how did the internet go from this?
You could actually find what you were looking for right away, bang,
to this.
I feel like I'm in hell.
Spoiler alert, it was not an accident. I'm Cory Doctorow, host of Who Broke the Internet from CBC's Understood. In this four-part series, I'm going to tell you why the internet sucks now, whose fault it is, and my plan to fix it. Find Who Broke the Internet on whatever terrible app you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Left, Right, and Center. I'm McKay Coppins, staff writer at The Atlantic, and your host this week, filling in for David Green. We have our usual Left, Right, and Center panel joining me this week. On the left, Mo Alathy, executive director at Georgetown University's Institute of Politics and Public Service. He was also communications director for the Democratic National Committee and an advisor to Hillary Clinton. And on the right, Sarah Isger, senior editor at The Dispatch and host of the Advisory Opinions podcast. She's a lawyer and was the spokesperson at the Department of Justice under President Trump. Hey, guys.
Hello.
Welcome back, McKay.
Happy to be here. So the first few months of Donald Trump's second term have revolved around executive orders from the White House. The next few months could focus on the president's influence over Capitol Hill. The White House Office of Management and Budget recently unveiled its budget proposal for 2026. Calls for bolstering border and defense spending in concert with the, quote, one big beautiful bill, President Trump's dream piece of spending, tax, and national security legislation that he hopes to push through Congress this summer. The proposed budget would reduce non-defense spending by $163 billion. That total includes cuts to federal housing and health programs, the FBI, and the EPA. They were described in a White House memo as, quote, eliminating radical diversity, equity, and inclusion, and critical race theory programs, green new scam funding, large swaths of the federal government weaponized against the American people, and moving programs that are better suited for states and localities to provide. Similar cuts were outlined by the Heritage Foundation's Project 2025 playbook, which makes sense, because Project 2025 was co-authored by Russell Vogt. Vogt is currently the director of the Office of Management and Budget, a job that gives him oversight over the entire $6 trillion federal budget. So I know you guys have been discussing the policy minds of today's federal government. I've been reporting on Russell Vogt and his plans to reshape the basic structure of the federal government. And he's interesting because usually, you know, the White House's budget is sort of a nudge from the president, right? But this budget could be read as more of a shove. Vogt has championed the controversial idea that the president can unilaterally cut funding to agencies in the executive branch through something called impoundment without consulting Congress. So this budget could actually foreshadow big fights to come between the White House and the legislative branch of the government. So, Mo, I want to start with you. Even if Russ Vogt doesn't get the fight that he's looking for, is this administration's, let's say, novel approach to separation of powers cause for concern to you?
Yeah, look, it's interesting. It wasn't that long ago that, at least from my perspective, the whole conservative movement was driven by sort of three principles, right? Limited government, strong national defense, and strict adherence to the Constitution. That was sort of going back to the Goldwater era, what defined what it meant to be a conservative in this country. I didn't agree with a lot of how they went about that, but like it was an ideology. The way this administration has been going isn't very conservative in a lot of ways. Sure, you could argue that their sort of decimation of federal agencies is one way to go about limiting the size and scope of government. But it sure as heck ain't adhering to the Constitution, at least as I see it, because the Constitution has built in very strict separation of powers between three co-equal branches of government. And this is an administration that's basically saying, when it comes to operating the government, we don't need the other two. They're going around Congress, which, in fairness, Congress is making it very easy to do.
Congress is just rolling over and saying, here you go, Mr. President, take the keys. And their willingness to pick fights with the judiciary, to challenge the judiciary, is setting us up for a showdown where this administration appears ready and willing to just ignore judicial rulings. So, yeah, I would say it's concerning and in some ways absolutely goes against sort of what it even means to be a conservative, or at least what it used to mean to be one.
Sarah, Mo got at something there, which is, you know, a lot of the kind of path that the Trump administration is taking here is a direct result of congressional dysfunction and inaction, right? Like, Congress has been so bad at kind of doing its basic job at passing legislation, approving budget appropriations for so long that it has created this power vacuum that both at various points the judiciary branch and now it seems the executive branch are looking to fill. Sarah, what do you make of the administration's approach to the budget?
I love when 100 years later, Democrats come around to like, maybe that separation of powers thing in the Constitution was a good idea after all. I mean, we are basically at the end of the line of Wilsonian democracy, and there's Donald Trump waving the Wilson flag. Yeah, this was a failed experiment. As it turns out, if you keep giving presidents more and more power and you keep taking that from Congress, everything gets out of whack. The judiciary becomes more important. Then all of a sudden we care who the judges are. We care who's picking the judges. It becomes this focus of our attention. And it so thoroughly changes the incentives in Congress that we have stopped having people who want to be legislators run for Congress. Instead, we are quickly getting to the point where we have 535 wannabe reality TV stars who weren't hot enough to be on Love Island or whatever. Not great, Bob. So here's the issue we have now. For the last, let's call it 10, 15 years, conservatives in the judiciary have been reinvigorating something that actually, at least arguably, was created by Justice Breyer during the Reagan administration called Major Questions Doctrine, and the like corollary to that one's called non-delegation doctrine. It's this idea that even if Congress is in rollover mode, there are certain things that Congress can't give away to the president. And if the president claims that Congress gave them away, you know, you can't do it in like a yada, yada, yada clause. You know what I mean? Like, they need to be clear that they were giving the president that power.
Is that the constitutional term? The yada, yada,
yeah,
yada,
yada, yada, yada clause? Yeah. And look no further than the Obama administration when it came to so many of Obama's executive actions, including DACA and DAPA. This was legal status for children who were brought here illegally, and then legal status for the parents of the children who were brought here illegally. He just did that through like magic wand waving when Congress didn't do what he wanted on that. And of course, that's where the famous pen and phone line comes. And then Trump comes into office and is like, hey, cool idea, bro. And he does his own versions of that with the bump stock ban, for instance. He makes a new crime if you own a bump stock because he didn't want Republicans in Congress to have to take a hard vote. God knows they're not taking any votes at all. And then you get to the Biden administration, eviction moratorium, vaccine mandate, student loan debt forgiveness. And then now Democrats are like, oh, shoot, now Donald Trump has these powers. So when it comes to the big, beautiful bill, I am really happy that Congress is doing something. I am not happy if Congress is simply giving more power to the president, but I'm actually fine if they're simply ratifying things the president has tried to do through executive orders, because those are dumb. But there is also this limitation that has been put on by the judiciary that liberals have decried for years, which is this idea that Congress cannot give away certain powers to the executive branch. And I'm glad to hear we're all on the same page on that now.
Well, okay, let's talk about the actual substance of the budget for a minute and the politics of it, because congressional Democrats have zeroed in on the kitchen table impact of the budget, right? Chuck Schumer called it a gut punch to American families. Congressional Republicans called out the lack of new funding for defense. They say it's basically a cut to spending considering inflation and its maintenance of Biden-era yearly defense funding. So Congress as a whole doesn't actually seem to like it. They just disagree on why. So Mo, will that agreement be enough to keep this from passing? Does that matter? I mean, what do you actually make of the budget itself?
I mean, on the politics of it, will it keep it from passing? I mean, as with most substantive things, the few substantive things we've seen so far this term, ask like the conservative hardliners in the House, right? Whether or not Speaker Johnson can hold the Republican conference together is going to be a big question. As a Democrat, thank you. It's about time, guys. Like, standing united against it with a message that this is bad for working families instead of chasing the little outrages, like, that's what people have been waiting to hear from Democrats. And he gives them a lot of stuff in there to make the case that, you know, Mr. President, you promised to make our lives easier, and you just keep making it harder by cutting these programs that we rely on at the same time that your tariffs are jacking up prices and raiding my retirement account. At the same time, you're making it harder by firing the guy who makes sure I've got my Social Security check on time. You're making our lives harder. And that, if Democrats can remain unified behind that message instead of doing what we tend to do, which is chase the latest outrage, whatever it may be, then that will send a clear message to voters. At the same time, you know, who the hell knows what Republicans are going to do?
Sarah, can you tell us what Republicans are going to do?
There's some horseshoe theory of politics here, right? And this is where, you know, several weeks ago, we talked about this new idea coming out of mainstream Democratic circles called Abundance Democrats, led by Ezra Klein and his new book, to give him a shout out and some credit.
And my colleague, Derek Thompson, who co-wrote the book.
So the idea of this is that Democrats have been doing a lot of activity, but not a lot of accomplishment, right? So they say, hey, look, we just gave $100 million to fix education in the country, but it actually all goes to teachers' unions and education continues to get worse, right? So like the idea of abundance Democrats is competence, basically, another word for that, like actually do the things that you think government should be doing. Don't just say you're doing the things and make all the groups happy, because you can't make everyone happy. That's the problem with government, is by the time you've like checked every single box, you have the California light rail system with billions of dollars and no light rail. I think Republicans are running into some of the same issues. Press release politics doesn't really work. Actual politics requires frustration and compromise and long-term planning and investment and stability. And so if you're checking all of these boxes with all of these groups, Doge is sort of a great example, right? It makes for great press releases. But like, we haven't talked about Doge much lately, and I still think there's fraud, waste, and abuse in the government. So it was a lot of activity, but what's the bottom line accomplishment? And I think that can be the problem for Republicans now.
I also wonder about how this budget that the White House released is being framed, because, you know, in their version of press release politics here, they're talking about it as, yes, rooting out waste, fraud, and abuse, but specifically taking on, you know, woke programs and the radical new scam, Green New Deal scam, whatever. I just wonder that when you actually look at the substance of it, cutting, for example, 40% of the funding to the CDC, would voters actually kind of connect those dots and say, yes, there must be 40% of woke programs in the CDC that need to be cut? Obviously, you know, well, it'll depend on what actually filters down and how people experience it in their daily lives. But do you think that messaging is a winner, Sarah?
All messaging from all political parties is all well and good until it affects people's lives. Like, people actually do care about messaging, for what that's worth. You know, there's a reason that they watch cable news. It's the reality TV of politics. So they do like that. They like the partisan battles. They like the negative polarization where you say, like, oh, maybe you don't like your team, but that team wants to destroy your way of life. Clearly, all of that is popular until and unless it actually affects their lives. And so, a little bit of both, right? It's very fun to say we're cutting this, we're doing that, we're causing this chaos because this system needs chaos, until there's no one answering the phone at the Social Security office, or their local whatever office isn't open anymore, things like that. So again, it's a balance, and we'll see whether Republicans can make that balance work. Brendan Buck, former staffer for Paul Ryan and John Boehner, had this op-ed in the New York Times where he basically said, this thing's a problem. They're making this bill too big to fail, to force all Republicans to get on board with it. But if you're just continuing a bunch of stuff and you're not actually delivering much, and in the meantime, tariffs are making things more expensive, Republicans are falling into a trap where they're not really doing legislation that does anything helpful.
It'll be fascinating to see how this plays out in the coming weeks and months. I will be right back with Moa Lathy and Sarah Isger to talk about the future of families in America. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center. Welcome back to Left, Right, and Center. I'm McKay Coppins, staff writer at The Atlantic, your host this week, filling in for David Green. We're joined by Moa Lathy, executive director at Georgetown University's Institute of Politics and Public Service, and Sarah Isger, lawyer, senior editor at The Dispatch, and former spokesperson at the Department of Justice under President Trump. One priority that has taken center stage in Trump 2.0 is the future of the American family. Children have been a constant at the White House since the inauguration, including a famous appearance by Elon Musk's four-year-old in the Oval Office. But what's driving the administration's laser-sharp focus on kids and family? For one thing, it's the birth rate. America's birth rate had been on a steady decline over the last 15 years. 2024 saw a slight increase over 2023, but major concerns remain. And it isn't just an American problem. It's suspected that 74% of nations will not have a sustainable fertility rate by 2050, and that number jumps to 97% of countries by 2100. The administration so far has considered a baby bonus of $5,000 for mothers. Department of Transportation head Sean Duffy outlined a proposal earlier this year to focus transportation funding on areas with higher birth rates and marriage rates. These directives from the administration line up with a growing movement on the right espousing pronatalism, basically a set of policies designed to encourage people to have more children.
I want more babies in the United States of America. I want more happy children in our country. And I want beautiful young men and women who are eager to welcome them into the world and eager to raise them. And it is the task of our government to make it easier for young moms and dads to afford to have kids, to bring them into the world, and to welcome them as the blessings that we know they are.
We're going to have tremendous, tremendous goodies in the bag for women, too. The women, between the fertilization and all of the other things that we're talking about, it's going to be great. We're joined today. Fertilization. I'm still very proud of it. I don't care. I'll be known as the fertilization president. That's okay. That's not bad.
Sarah, when we mentioned discussing this topic this week, you said that you saw it as Trump pushing the left into an unpopular position. What do you mean by that? What position do you think that is?
So what I think we've seen as Trump realigns the Republican Party, the Democratic Party responds by also realigning. You know, think of it as two little half spheres that move around one another. If one sphere moves a little, the other one moves in the same direction, because when you have a two-party system, they hit equilibrium. That's sort of the purpose of them. It's why we can't have third parties, or at least functioning third parties in this country, because if they get too popular, one of the two major parties absorbs them like an amoeba, and we get back to that equilibrium issue that we're on. So what you've seen since 2016 is that anything Donald Trump says, the Democratic Party feels like they need to stand in opposition to that. Well, a lot of the times that's worked out pretty well. Some of the times, not so much. And this is one of those areas where I think that standing against Donald Trump's message has not worked particularly well for the Democratic Party. Now, to be clear, the right and the left both have plenty of crazy when it comes to everything, but especially when it comes to the sort of culture war, sex and family type things. But the Republican Party has a leader of the party in Donald Trump, and so his message drowns out the crazy. It's hard to say, well, the Republican Party stands for whatever rando on Twitter said, because Donald Trump is out there saying stuff. The Democratic Party doesn't have a leader right now, so their crazies end up getting magnified. And to be clear, the same thing was happening to the Republican Party in the wake of the 2012 loss by Mitt Romney as well. So nothing new under the sun there. But as the Republican Party becomes the pro-natalist party, you see these fringe Democrats, and I do think they're fringe, although many of them are elected to office. So I don't mean fringe like I'm just pulling people off Twitter. And the idea that, like, don't have kids because of climate change. We shouldn't be adding to the population that's hurting the earth. And a general, like, side eye at families. That, like, that's what Republicans look like. They look like a happy family. Democrats should look like unhappy single people. And I'm thinking of this, what do you call it? Like a photo spread that was in one of those like fashion magazines with a bunch of leading progressives. Al Sharpton was in it. Huma Abedin and her, is he fiance or boyfriend? Soros, Alex Soros. And like everyone in this photo spread of progressives looked miserable, and their houses looked antiseptic. And it was this like vibe of progressivism that you should be unhappy in a beige life. And I think that is a reaction to J.D. Vance and Donald Trump. And I think in the end, it's not going to resonate with a lot of people.
Yeah, I'm still waiting to hear, though, how he has pushed the left into unpopular positions. You and I are in full agreement that there's plenty of crazy on both sides. And you mentioned some of the fringe statements and positions that some on the left have made. That's not where the mainstream of the left is. And in fact, what I hear is I'm actually very happy to hear that this Republican Party under this president is actually pushing a pro-natalist agenda. Because you could argue that much of the left's agenda for a very long time has been pro-natalist as well. Now, I think the president's going to have some issues on some of the things he's talked about. First of all, I hope we can be in agreement that, and this is not a partisan statement, that nobody wants to hear their president call themselves the fertilization president in this context.
I physically recoiled.
But, yeah. But... like, oh, dear Lord. But,
and McKay is blushing. Like, McKay wants none of this.
He really is. Yeah, look at that.
I don't, no comment, but I will not be using that term myself in my writing or reporting.
But the president, you know, there are plenty of elected leaders in the Republican Party all over the country, for example, who are standing up against IVF. Whereas, you know, if the president can pull them along, great. But he's going to face some issues within the fringe of his own party. But a lot of the Democratic agenda, you could argue, is pro-natalist, because a lot of the Democratic agenda and the progressive agenda focuses on making life easier for families, which is seen by a lot of people as being key to a pro-natalist agenda, to helping encourage strong families by removing some of the obstacles that stress out parents and potential parents, by focusing on things like universal
or greater access, at the very least, to childcare and pre-K, greater access to paid family leave, to affordable housing. Things like that are obstacles for, we all hear it, the president talks about very often about all the young people in America that are having trouble getting jobs or affording housing and how tough it is for them. This is what a lot of Democrats have been arguing. And so to me, a true pronatalist agenda tackles some of those issues, some of the financial and social obstacles that young adults face that have pushed a lot of them to choose not to start families, at least until later, because of that anxiety in their lives. If we can find ways to come to an agreement on some of those issues, right, then that's great. Both parties, I think, the mainstream, not the fringes, but the mainstream of both parties are both pushing pronatalist agendas. They just got different ways to go about it.
Ooh, I think Mo has struck on something really interesting, McKay, which is the difference between vibes around the culture of the parties, you know, what it means to look like a Democrat or look like a Republican, versus the policies actually promoted by the two parties. And those can be really different at any given moment.
No kidding.
And right now 100%. Feels like one of the times where the vibes look really different than the policies on both sides.
This is what I was going to say, listening to the two of you talk. This is one of those issues where I feel like the right and the left actually do have a lot of common ground in terms of policy, but they're just speaking totally different languages, right? Like, they frame the problem in very different ways to appeal to their respective coalitions. And because of that, they're kind of repulsed or repelled by the way the other side talks about it. And that becomes an obstacle to actually, finding policies that could address the issue. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center from KCRW. We're talking about policy ideas around America's declining birth rate with Sarah Isger and Mo Alathy. Mo, when you were talking, I was thinking about this piece that my colleague Liz Brunig at The Atlantic wrote, arguing that the left should embrace pronatalism despite the kind of instinct to reject it due to its popularity on the right. And she said, I'll quote from it. She said, "The policies associated with pronatalism naturally belong to the left, and there is a progressive case for making the country more welcoming to families in hopes of achieving a range of benefits, including a bump in the birth rate." Why, though, do you think, Mo, that there is this kind of like, because I think what Sarah's saying is true. There is this aversion to framing these policies on the left in terms of pronatalism. Like, there's kind of almost like an ickiness that a lot of progressives feel about saying we should be incentivizing more babies in America. Do you think that's wrong?
Yeah, I think, first of all, I don't think anybody outside of, a handful of folks around the country will ever think of the term pronatalist, right? Like, that's not how people think about it. How do we encourage families, strong families? And I think where the left is reacting poorly, but sometimes doesn't see the forest through the trees, where they're reacting poorly is sort of this notion, maybe Sarah's right that it's a perception thing, though I think there's plenty of policy to back this up, that almost is borderline compulsion at times, right? Like, we're going to encourage more children by banning abortion. And that doesn't sit well with a lot of folks. And in fact, the data also shows that in states with the most restrictive anti-abortion policies after the Dobbs decision, the birth rates have actually gone down so far. And we've seen that in other countries as well, where they've experimented with that. When you see some of those types, that kind of rhetoric from the right tied to this issue, then there's a revulsion to it by folks on the left. And I can understand that. But when that becomes the extent of the argument, and we don't take that next step, as we've been doing here, talking about, no, if we want to encourage more people to have families, let's figure out what the obstacles are to them having more families and attack that. And to the extent that those are economic challenges, then that's where we can step in.
So I've got bad news for everyone in this conversation. Every modernized country in the world at this point is trying to incentivize higher birth rates, and literally nothing has worked because the reason that it's worldwide has to do with women. And it turns out if you give women an option, they just have fewer children. And that's true in Japan and South Korea and Russia and the United States and France and the UK and countries, regardless of their language, their religion, or anything else. It all has to do with women making choices. So I don't know that the policy conversation matters a lot for pronatalist reasons. I think it matters a lot because some of these are just good policies. All right. But the vibes thing I find really fascinating. You know, not only was there the like, don't have babies because of climate change, don't get married because that's not feminist. There was also the really creepy, like, you can't have cross-racial adoptions because that's white supremacist behavior. And kind of doing the side eye at Amy Coney Barrett because she had so many children, right? That was her confirmation hearing for her circuit court position, where Dianne Feinstein says, the dogma lives loudly within you, kind of making fun of her deeply held religious beliefs. So I think the cultural thing is a problem for Democrats because, well, there's two. One, again, there's that antiseptic beige lifestyle that I just don't think is going to attract a whole lot of normal people. But also, and you hear this among the right all the time, so Democrats who don't know this, like, this is what the right says: we will outbreed them. It's basically the idea that, like, liberals are going to die off because they don't get married and they don't have children. In the meantime, the Republicans are having seven kids. And in the end, in like one or two generations, there just won't be liberals left.
There's your great replacement theory.
Exactly.
Look, no, again, you know, I do not think some of the examples that you just mentioned are even remotely widespread beliefs held by the left. You got some loony left out there. You've got some crazy right out there. In fact, I hear more progressives talking about how tackling climate change can actually help with rising birth rates, not don't go have more kids because it's going to be bad for the environment, but that by going after more sustainable family policies out there, by investing in things like green infrastructure and healthcare and issues like that, that mitigate environmental impact, then it actually can help increase birth rates. That is a more widely held position on the left than those who are out there saying don't have babies.
Here's a poll that says, I think it's roughly half of US adults say they have reconsidered having children. Climate change has made them reconsider having children.
But the left isn't saying don't have them, right? The left is saying, so let's tackle climate change. If you're that worried about it, that it's going to impact what your decision on whether or not to start a family. They're saying, let's go out there and invest in healthcare and invest in childcare and invest in early childhood education so that if you are worried about those costs, if you're worried about the world that you'd be bringing a child into, let's make that world a little bit easier to live in so that you can go out there and have more children. That's what the progressive case is for pronatalism. And that's what I think is the more widespread belief than some of the things you've referenced.
Op-ed in the New York Times from this summer: the success narratives of liberal life leave little room for having children.
So you got an op-ed in the New York Times.
I don't think we're going to solve this on this on this one conversation, though.
Really?
I will say that I am pro having babies, as are, I think, my co-hosts here. But we'll have to figure out how to make it easier for everyone.
McKay's beating
episode.
Us all, to be clear.
We just had my fourth is napping upstairs as we speak. I have been talking with Sarah Isger and Moa Lathy. We'll be back to discuss how ChatGPT could affect the next generation. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center. Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm McKay Coppins, filling in for David Green. We're here with Sarah Isger and Moa Lathy. Artificial intelligence is seen as the future of many industries, but what impact could it have on learning? That's the question at the heart of a new story in New York Magazine this week titled Everyone is Cheating Their Way Through College. The story looks at the explosion of AI use among current university students and the inability of college professors to properly detect it. Some students are taking AI-generated essays and feeding them into other AI tools to make them sound more authentic. And while these undergrads are growing proficient with using generative AI, the long-term effects on learning and problem-solving aren't yet known. Mo, I want to start with you because you work at a university. Has your on-campus experience with generative AI kind of tracked with what we read in this New York Magazine story? What's it been like for you?
I mean, I'm not in the classroom, so I don't have to read assignments and I don't see it. But I do know colleagues who are in the classroom are concerned about it. And as the parent of a high school student, I'm concerned about it. I get it. Every generation has new tools that the previous generation doesn't understand. I get it. Like, this is progress in some ways, and it's going to reshape how people interact with learning. And we always have to learn to adapt to that. But at the same time, what really, really worries me is this is one of those tools that, if not used properly, can eliminate the need to think. If I just type in a prompt and say, give me an answer, and I don't have to think, what we're supposed to be doing in education, yeah, teaching them the fundamentals, but more importantly, teaching young people how to think critically. How to come up with an argument, how to support that argument, how to advocate for that argument. And, you know, if we're going to just let the computers and robots do that for us, and by continuing to ask them to do that for us, just making them more sophisticated in doing that, we become less sophisticated, and then the robots just win. And I don't mean to be completely flip about that, but they do. And that means less need to hire people who with critical thinking skills because the robots can just do it for us.
Yeah. Well, and there is already evidence that the kind of white collar entry level jobs that new college graduates tend to get funneled into are disappearing, and many, you know, experts believe that they could increasingly be turned into AI jobs. But I'm going to be kind of the devil's advocate in this conversation, just in case the AI overlords take over. They know they have an ally in me. But Sarah, is there a case to be made that this is kind of another reflexive overreaction to new technology? It happens with every generation, right? Like, back in the day, there were teachers who thought that it was outrageous that calculators would be allowed to be used in the classroom. Or I even remember in high school and college, teachers were not clear on how much we should be allowed to use the internet in our research, right? So is this all kind of a big overreaction and we all just sound like old people shouting at clouds?
So this is the calculator issue, but bigger, certainly. And the calculator didn't make us dumber. It made us less reliant on people who can be really good at those types of calculations. There are always winners and losers with new technology. But frankly, what I read in that story was a lot of professors unable to think creatively and meet the moment. They mention it in short, having, you know, handwritten exams or cutting off the Wi-Fi to the room during an exam. My God, we took all of my law school exams were on Blue Book, like as in you wrote them in a specific blue book that they gave you with loose leaf paper in it. So there's certainly ways to maintain some of what we've been doing. But at the same time, these kids also need to learn how to use the calculator, right? How to use AI, because we're going to make far bigger advancements with the calculator than we are if we just pretend there's no calculator. Now, again, there will be winners and losers in the overall economic world. And I think here of computers and what they did. And I'm going to use this very specific example, but to legal secretaries. It used to be the case that a lawyer was sort of only as good as his legal secretary, and they would be, you know, like a bonded pair of penguins throughout their entire career. It's not that those legal secretaries were fired for the most part. It's that the incoming generation just didn't hire a legal secretary because they were computer proficient. And so fast forward 20 or so years, and the entire career, which was a really well-earning legal career of legal secretary, no longer really exists. So I think you will see those types of entry-level jobs, as you talked about, disappear, whether it's, you know, the new associate at the law firm that's not as good as, you know, doing first drafts of brief as AI, and any number of other sort of entry writing where we used to teach people to write. And yeah, it means that we need to learn, we need to teach these kids how to use AI, not freak out, think of it like the computer or the calculator, and at the same time, just have them do oral exams, have them stand up. Because if you want to talk about defending your beliefs, Mo, you should be able to do that verbally as well. And that's just the professors needing to think creatively and frankly, needing to put in more time, because it's harder to do oral exams. It's harder to read written exams. But this isn't, well, we don't need AI to solve this problem. How about that?
And look, Sarah, I totally agree with everything you just said. I'm not saying eliminate AI. I'm not saying take the tool away. I'm just saying we need to teach them how to use it properly. We need to make sure it is being utilized properly. And I love all the examples you just gave. I love every example you just gave about blue books, about oral presentations. We just need to make sure that we are not, and that the professors, the instructors, the educators need to get more creative, because this is not going away. And I want a world where everyone is proficient with AI. I'm worried about people becoming too reliant on it, and that we're training an entire generation to get the easy answer without the critical thinking skills behind them.
Yeah, you know, I have been experimenting more with ChatGPT recently, in part because I've been talking to some people in the tech world who say that there really are amazing ways that you can use it to kind of, you know, as for example, Reid Hoffman, an early investor in OpenAI, said it can actually promote and enhance human agency if you learn how to use it right. One thing, though, that I've noticed is that it does help if you are proficient in language and sharpen your thinking already, because the more specific you can get in your prompts to the AI, the better the kind of result that it spits out. My question to you, Mo, I agree with you clearly, and what Sarah said, clearly educators, professors, college administrators need to be thinking more about this. And my favorite detail from that piece was that there are some professors who have just kind of fully given up and actually started using AI to grade papers as well. So we have a situation where there are essays produced by AI being handed in by students and then graded by AI, and the whole educational process has become basically robots talking to each other. That sounds a little dystopian. My question to you, though, is should policymakers be thinking about how to address this? I mean, clearly this could become one of the defining issues of the next generation, not just in terms of how AI is being used in college campuses, though that might be kind of the canary in the coal mine, but in general, how should our politicians, lawmakers, policymakers be thinking about this issue?
Well, look, I mean, if the past 10, 20 years is any indication, I don't think federal policymakers from either party have proven themselves to be ready to meet the moment of how to regulate or address major tech issues, right? I mean, they can't. They you know, how many pieces of meaningful, successful legislation have we seen? Now, that's not to say they shouldn't be talking about it and putting a spotlight on it, and maybe there are things, but this is not going to be solved in the halls of Congress. This is going to have to be solved on campuses around the country, and I trust that there are going to be smart people who are thinking about it. And again, coming up with a framework, a curriculum, so to speak, of how to prepare young people to responsibly use AI. Like, they're going to need that. They're going to need that in the future workforce. If they don't learn how to do it responsibly, then there are going to be fewer jobs for them in the future workforce. So it is incumbent on us to figure this out.
Yeah, I mean, that has been my biggest takeaway from using these tools just a little bit. I feel like it's just inevitable that these are going to become kind of regular features of daily life in the years to come. And knowing how to use them is going to be essential to making yourself kind of a valuable participant in society. But it is scary.
And look, it's not just the classroom, right? It's not just the classroom where this is becoming an issue with young people.
Yeah. I mean,
there's all sorts of stories out there right now looking at how people are relying on ChatGPT for relationships, for friendships, where people are foregoing close personal relationships with other human beings and calling their their chatbot their best friend, or developing romantic feelings for it, right? Like, we've seen this with social media. We're seeing it with AI. The technology is moving so fast and is so accessible to young people so early that I'm worried we're not preparing young people on how to use it responsibly until it's too late.
All right, we're going to leave it there. And again, AI overlords, just know that you have an ally in us here if you take over. We have reached that time once again for our famed Left, Right, and Center rants and raves, featuring pet peeves and projects from across the political spectrum. Sarah, what didn't we get to today?
I'll give a rave to the new Pope, having an American Pope for the first time. Y'all, this is really exciting and cool, just from a historical perspective. And I'm not even a Catholic, but I'm rooting for all you Catholics out there. And I know this was an exciting week. So congrats to Catholics, to the new Pope, and to America. I think you're finally on the map, young country.
You know, Sarah, like, my rave actually flows from that too. Because now that we've got an American Pope and a Pope from Chicago, I did what we all do, which was I went to Twitter to see what the reaction was. And so, and I've got to say, as much as I hate Twitter and the cesspool of discourse that it has become, for, you know, in the moments after Pope Leo was named, I was very proud to see people giving Chicago deep dish pizza its due. People making jokes about deep dish pizza beating out Italian pizza, about the Pope serving the body of Christ at Mass over a photo of deep dish pizza. Americans at least, seem to be very excited about what this Pope will mean to the whole genre of deep dish pizza. And I got to say, in this one case, well done, Twitter.
I also have a Pope-themed rave for today. And this is a rave for the movie Conclave. It's a movie that came out last year, actually a dramatic kind of thriller set at the Vatican, where a new conclave is deciding who will be the new Pope. It, you know, won awards. It was an excellent movie. It also has inspired all kinds of memes during this conclave, where people kind of try to explain how the conclave works based on what they saw in this movie. What's kind of amazing, though, is there was a report that actually many of the cardinals who participated in this conclave were relatively new to their positions, had never participated in a conclave before, and actually watched the film Conclave to get an idea of what to expect. And so we really have this kind of strange life imitating art, imitating life situation going on. I would love to see kind of a you know, documentary about this conclave from all the cardinals who watched the movie Conclave. Anyway, great movie. I encourage everyone to go watch it. My understanding from speaking to Catholics who know a lot more about this than I do, is that it maybe lacks a bit in verisimilitude. There probably isn't quite so much drama at these conclaves, but nevertheless, worthwhile to check out and newly timely and topical. All right, that's all we have for today. Thank you to Sarah Isger and Moa Lathy. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Mark K. Green. Our executive producer is Arnie Seipel. The show is recorded by Sue Margulies and mixed by Nick Clamponi. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. Left, Right, and Center is a co-production of KCRW and Fearless Media. We are distributed by PRX. I'm McKay Coppins, sitting in for David Green. Thanks for joining us. Tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.
From PRX.